Hello everyone, and welcome to this podcast where we dive into the transformative power of artificial intelligence in the scholarly world. I'm your host, Apurva Nagvekar, and I'm working as Director of Data Science at Trinkai AI. This is my first podcast where I'm basically hosting it. So please bear with me if I make any mistakes. So today we are exploring how AI is reshaping scholarly communication, the integrity of academic work, and the future of publishing. With us, we have Avi Stamen, a distinguished expert in AI technologies and their applications in academia. So he's the founder and CEO of Academic Language Experts, which is author services company dedicated to leveling the research playing field for ESL scholars. He's also co-founder of SciWriter.ai, which is the first co-pilot that helps researchers with their writing with responsible AI. Avi, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Apurva. And I have to say, I remember my first time that I was podcasting and hosting, and I was nervous and I made all sorts of mistakes. So good luck to you. I hope that it goes really well. And even if there's always what to learn and improve, even if you've done 100 of these. So
yeah, thanks a lot, Avi. Yeah, thanks a lot. So I hope I don't make many mistakes.
You're off to a good start, so no worries.
Yeah, thanks a lot. So let's start with our first segment that is on technical intricacies of AI algorithms in scholarly communication. So Avi, could you share with us the primary AI technologies currently in use with scholarly communication?
Yeah, I mean, so it's a really interesting question, and I want to preface by saying that I'm not like a technical expert in the sense that I'm not a computer scientist. So I'm not going to dive into the, deep details or under the hood exactly what's going on. But the way I see it, there are a number of different kind of areas where AI, I would say, is already kind of disrupting or interrupting how it is that we do research or how it is that we approach research. And then there's a whole nother category of higher education and learning with students, which is there's all sorts of tools there. So I don't want to touch on the learning and students. We'll leave that for another time, maybe. But if we're thinking about research, so first of all, I like to think about the what I call generic AI tools, the general AI tools, which, under those tools, I include ChatGPT, which I assume everyone's familiar with, Midjourney for images, Jasper for marketing writing. These are tools that are created for the masses. They're created for, all sorts of different people in different places. And can really be used by a big, swath of people. On the other side, now the problem with those tools is, they're great in many ways, but they also come with their own set of issues. So, probably you've heard of hallucinations or misinformation that some of these tools can provide. Or you may have heard of situations where, it makes up references, that don't exist. And all these things tend to frustrate researchers. For researchers really put a prime value on the truth and on fact, and we get really upset when we see these kinds of issues coming up. So what's happened is actually there's been this kind of, I would call it a subgroup of AI companies and startups that have been developed to help researchers work through the research process. So that could be a literature review and asking questions to large language models that are built on the scientific literature. That can be help with writing and editing tools. That can be help with research dissemination. And these are all, most of these companies are either companies that were founded by researchers or research professionals who are really trying to address the specific issues that researchers have. So I'm excited about AI in general, but I'd like to say that I'm specifically excited about the AI for research tools because I think it can really make a difference in how we work.
I see. So can you name some of the tools which are available for scholarly researchers for them to use it, or like some of the applications, like, or the challenges like hallucination, reference management can be solved using this like AI technology?
Yeah, so if we go through like the the thought process of or like the process of writing an article or even just doing our research, I think we can go through the entire lifeline of that process and think about okay, what tools are available in order to help us at that specific point. So when I'm first starting out and I want to come up with research questions, there's a brand new tool called ResearchKit, which was just put out a few weeks ago, that can help us like brainstorm research questions and try to come up with what's new and what would fill a gap, which I think is really cool. Then if we move on to kind of research literature reviews trying to understand that, which is a big problem because, you know, as the literature grows, it's hard to kind of, you know, stay on top of everything that's happening. So, in that context, you've got consensus, you've got Perplexity AI. One that I specifically like is SciSpace. So SciSpace is a really cool tool where you can kind of go in, you can ask the literature questions and get answers and actually chat with the literature via the chatbot. You can get suggested, you can get really smart summaries. So let's say I just want to know the methodology in the following five articles, I can do that. Or if I just want to know the results, or I just want to see, who was involved, or maybe I want to find the people that were involved in that article, it's very intelligent searching. So it's not just keyword and now I get a result and I have to go through all these results and most of them are not relevant. It's actually very relevant results to your study. I can track it in SciSpace, for example. I can sort it by what is the most recent literature, right? So I can see what's just been produced. So that's really cool in terms of the research and literature search. If we're moving down the line, I would say their GPT can be used for data analysis, which is a cool use case. And then there's the writing and editing thing. So, when it comes to writing, so I'm working on a tool now called SciWriter AI that you mentioned at the outset, which I'm very excited about, which is a structured writing process, especially for early career researchers, as well as researchers for whom English is a second language. We just produced the prototype this week, and we're iterating on it now. And we're actually looking for researchers who are interested in getting involved in an early point in testing, so that we can really make the whole writing process a lot easier, take a lot less time, and write in really great English from the outset. And then there are good editing tools out there. I know Trinka is close to your heart, Apoorva, yeah. Right? Editing texts that are already created, that already exist. There are other companies out there that are doing similar things, mm-hmm. Which I think are still important, especially when you take into the fact that, the general tools, again, ChatGPT or like Grammarly, they generally are not trained on the scientific literature. So I think we're understanding through the AIs is, the more that the source of the information is reliable and trustworthy, the better the output is going to be. And that's why, science-based, I'm always a fan of science-based, research.
I see. That's very insightful. Building on that, there are many companies who use ChatGPT directly in their product, right? Do you see that it's a challenge for end users to use it directly? Because many of the time when you use ChatGPT directly or Gemini in that case, they are not fine-tuned on academic data or research data. So do they give good results or after using it, people feel that, I should have tried something else or this model is not doing right because it's not trained on scholarly articles. So,
I mean, I think we need to remember what ChatGPT is and what it isn't, and that helps to frame the conversation. So first of all, what I would say is people oftentimes think that ChatGPT is kind of like Wikipedia, but personalized for them, right? It's like a Wikipedia they can ask questions to. Well, that's not really how it's built. It's built as a large language model. It's not a large information model. So I actually think that GPT's best use cases are around language, are around crafting language, editing text, translating text, summarizing text, crunching and getting and processing the information within text. When you're asking for answers to specific questions, then all of a sudden I'm not sure GPT, is always the best solution, especially as it's not, actively live connected to the internet. So there are other tools, that either are extensions of GPT or work independently. So Scholar AI is one that comes to mind where I can actually, or Perplexity, where I can actually ask a research question and get a research answer that's based on the scientific literature. Now, it's not the entire scientific literature because a lot of the scientific literature is still, blocked behind paywalls, which is a problem. And it's hard to access that because publishers don't usually, give away that information very easily. But that being said, I don't know, I'm just thinking about if we wanted to build, for example, a use case for doctors to get real answers to medical questions on the spot when they're treating a patient, I don't think we would want to use an LLM that was trained on Reddit, right? Or that was trained on, you know, BuzzFeed. We want an LLM that was trained on the scientific literature. So I think that's, you know, I even think that the scientific publishing, scholarly publishing, doesn't even realize the value of its own content. Or, you know, maybe we do, but we haven't figured out how to monetize it yet or how to turn it into a product that can be really beneficial. So once you realize and understand that, well, in real use cases, we're going to want to build off the scientific literature, and this is our industry, this is our business. We need to figure out how we can level up to actually, you know, bring that literature to, you know, to the use cases where it can really be beneficial. So, you know, it's this funny dance, because on the one hand, you know, publishers tend to not like, you know, OpenAI and Claude and, you know, Anthropic, who made Claude, and because they ingested their content arguably without permission. But on the other hand, I think the only way forward is to combine the technology of, you know, these big tech companies with the publisher's content and to really get results that we're happy with.
That's very insightful and incredibly enlightening too. Let's try to move, like, you know, from abstract concepts to concrete examples. Let's focus on some of the anecdotes. So I'm particularly excited about this part, and I also guess, like, our viewers too are pretty excited about it. Could you share with us some specific instances where machine learning models or NLP techniques that have produced significantly results in academic research or scholarly communication? What you have experienced about it, like, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, one, you know, there's been a lot of really interesting work that's done in chemistry, actually, with predicting certain chemical compounds that would be, you know, you have to run so many scripts, you know, to do that manually would be impossible. But to come up with formulas for drug production, I think has been a really valuable use case. I don't know as much about that, but that sounds like a really interesting, you know, kind of application. What I do understand a little bit more about is there were two researchers from the Technion Institute in Israel who came up with this data to paper in an hour. And this was actually published in Nature, where they took a data set from the CDC, if I'm not mistaken, and they ran it through GPT. Now, they were computer scientists, so they, you know, they knew how to manipulate the algorithms, but they ran it through GPT. Were able to actually produce a legitimate study in an hour on, I believe it was the health effects of vegetable consumption amongst diabetes, people with diabetes. And it was just crunching data, really, right? But they knew how to take that, you know, manipulate it and turn it into a scientific paper in a way that was, you know, really compelling. So I think, you know, that's just one example. I'm not saying that everyone should be writing their papers in an hour. And of course, we run the risk when we allow these, you know, when we enable these tools that they can be used for bad as well as for good. So we need to keep an eye on that. But I think, like, that's just an example where, you know, anyone who is listening to this who's had frustrations writing a paper before and just, you know, is like, you know, breaking their teeth, you know, maybe because English isn't your native language, or maybe because you're not used to writing in this scientific formula. I mean, that's what I'm trying to build at SciWriter, you know, to solve this problem. But I think to be able to actually bring that to fruition, to you know, to write the paper in an hour, you know, I think is everybody's dream. And while we might not get there tomorrow, I think it is an attainable goal if we chip away at it, you know, slowly but surely.
I see. That's very insightful. So just to update here, we at Trinka AI, we are also working on some cool stuff like RLHF. So to give you an overview, we have our own in-house grammar error correction engine, which has really good accuracy, and it does advanced grammar error correction. But sometimes some of our clients need specific changes tailored to their domain showing all changes may be irritating feeling. So we incorporate RLHF on in-house grammar error correction model using some sort of preferential data which was provided by the client. And we saw that, you know, after implementing RLHF, it moved towards the client need. And we also observed that, like, you know, with more preferential data, it was moving closer to client need. So now RLHF, just to like, you know, to simplify this, like, you know, it's a reinforcement learning technique, which was on which the ChatGPT model was built on. And like, it was introduced in 2017 by OpenAI, but, like, you know, after ChatGPT became pretty huge and we thought of integrating it in our application, and we also got really good results with that. So that was a pretty exciting part from our end as well.
Yeah. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I've done some testing, and I did say before that I do believe in general in the power of, you know, the science-specific models. Specifically when it comes to language, I'm not yet sure, because I have been testing GPT, and I have been testing, you know, and I've tested Trinka and other tools in the industry. And I think on the one hand, yes, there's maybe, you know, I think it Trinka is, or not Trinka, but just all these tools, right, that are out there, they are good in the sense that they're a little bit more careful and they know scientific language. Yeah. But they don't necessarily have the data set, I think, that some of the bigger large language models do. So there's a trade-off there, right? And it's like, well, what's more powerful? Is it the more specific, you know, scientific terminology, or is it the ability to really reconstruct sentences that need a lot of help? So I think it depends on who you are and what stage you're at and how much work you need, you know. So for those researchers who just need like a kind of a lighter touch, but really to make sure that it's, you know, polished, I think that the tools that we've built in our industry are really powerful and helpful. But when, if you're, you know, really trying to improve, like, you know, get your hands dirty, there I've actually seen, you know, GPT be pretty impressive, sometimes even better than some of the specialized tools.
True. Like, just to add here, like, you know, there are lots of open source models which are there right now. And there are, like, models like Llama 2, then there's Mistral, there are the T5 family models. So they are trained on very lot of data, right? I mean, and when you fine tune them using some small section of data of particular academic domain, then, like, you know, it starts giving really good results. And we also observe the same thing. Like, you know, if we train like, you know, model from scratch, then it might not give you very good precision or recall, but the accuracy might not be that great. But like, when you use this open source model, then, like, you know, it gives, right, really good results. When I talk about this, like, you know, when I take, like, very minimal amount of data in hand, like, that's what, like, you know, clients have. Like, you know, most of the clients don't have, like, massive amount of data. They just have like minimal amount of data, like 1,000 data points or like 10,000 data.
Also, don't forget that there's the level of repetition when it comes to academic text. I mean, it's not that maybe certain phrases are repeated over and over, but, you know, the whole idea of academia is you're supposed to be always coming up with something new and novel. And there's so many subfields and niches that it's kind of, sometimes it's hard to really, you know, kind of really fully capture everything that's going on in research. So, you know, just because something is trained on research, a researcher in literature is going to want something very different from a researcher in sociology is going to want something very different from a researcher in biomedicine, right? So, you know, it's almost a never ending, right, niche, you know, that you can get into. And, you know, I think it's still early days, and we'll have to see over time what the best, you know, what really produces the best. And when I say best, you know, it's also a very subjective question. You know, I don't think one thing I've learned from being, you know, running academic language experts over the last 10 years and being actively involved in the author services industry is that, you know, within the range of good editing, there are different styles, right? And a lot of it is stylistic, right? So you have people who really take a heavy hand and really make the text better. And some authors like that, and some authors don't like that. Some authors like keep maintaining their own voice better. So there's not like there's objective gold standard of here's what a good paper looks like, right? A good paper can look like a lot of different things. So we want to make sure, I think, that we balance between giving these, you know, a level playing field for researchers for whom English is not their first language, but on the other hand, not overdoing it and taking away their personal voice, you know, as well. So that's a balance.
I see. Can you throw some light on literature reviews? Like, you know, how like, you know, this AI tools are helping in literature review, especially in searching documents, like, you know, answering queries, summarizing the entire document, like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, right now, the typical way that a researcher goes about a literature review, you know, they may search PubMed, they may go onto Google Scholar and search there, and then they start going through each and every, you know, entry, and they're usually based on keywords. You know, so if the keywords are generic, then you may get a lot of stuff that's not related. If the keywords are too specific, you might not get any answers. So it's really quite, it's funny because, you know, we always thought of Google and Google Scholar as like, you know, kind of the pinnacle of advancement. And now all of a sudden, Google seems like it's kind of outdated, at least in this specific context, right? It's obviously still very good for many other things. But what, you know, what tools like Sciespace and Elicit is another really good one that I recommend. What they can really do is like you said, first of all, is you have this tremendous corpus of information. So if you just search for keywords, you're going to get all sorts of stuff. But if you ask specific questions, these tools know how to say, okay, I get what you're trying. I get a little bit more about what you're aiming, what your end goal is, or your research question is. Now I can direct you more specifically to studies that have addressed this specific issue. And it's just a much more sophisticated semantic search than it is, you know, just a traditional keyword search. And what that, and then, so that's kind of part one to it. And then part two is what I mentioned before about the user experience and kind of the interface is, instead of me going one at a time and looking through and finding out, I actually have this dynamic, you know, summary that I get, where I see the summary of, you know, I may get a summary, I can get a layman summary. Let's say I'm not a researcher in the field, or I study a different field, or I don't know, I have a relative who's sick, you know, God forbid, and I want to understand what the potential treatment plans are. I can go in and get a scientific summary, a layman summary. I can ask for, you know, specific methods, and I can really, and I can almost converse, you know, I want to be careful not to make it too human, but I can converse and engage in a dialogue with an article, not just with a chatbot, but with an article, and ask questions, and I'm trying to understand better. Now, I want to give a word of caution. That can hallucinate as well. There's no, even if you have a model that's trained 100% on the scientific literature, that doesn't mean that every answer and every chat that I get is going to be accurate. You know, I think these are bigger challenges that we're trying to tackle. But for me, the number one benefit is when we have these, you know, if let's say as a researcher, there are, I don't know, 300 articles in your field, and there's no way for you to read all of them. All of a sudden, there's this way of shrinking that down to 100. And then out of those 100, maybe I go through the summaries and I pick out 20 that I want to dig into further. And then I go and I read those articles. I'm not suggesting that we don't need to read articles anymore. The opposite. I'm suggesting that let's take the time to read the articles that are really most important to us and hyper-focus our attention on that, as opposed to reading through a lot of articles where by the time we get to the end of the article, we're like, all right, that wasn't relevant. Next article, right? Which I think everybody has spent a lot of time doing that.
Yeah, that's nice. So I will also like to add that we have our own product called as AnagoRaid, which helps users to effectively do their literature review by skimming through you know, related papers. And we also have a mechanism that extracts the key insights from the paper, performs summarization on that. And we also have something like, you know, Copilot engine in place where researchers can ask questions to it. And you know, and it gives answers accordingly. So we use here, like, you know, technique like REG concept, where, like, you know, the co-pilot gives, so that, you know, the co-pilot gives correct and accurate results by minimizing the hallucination. So I think the most of the tools which hallucinates, I think by applying REG on that, you know, it tries to minimize it. I won't say, like, you know, it removes the hallucination completely, but, you know, the ratio of the hallucination decreases drastically. So, yeah.
You know, and that's just a sign of how fast this industry is moving, because I didn't even know, right? And I'm really excited to hear that you've been working on this, because maybe, you know, there's just so many tools out there that it's, you know, it's hard to keep up with all of them and make sure that we're on top of everything. So thank you for bringing that to my attention, and I'll be sure to check that out as soon as we're
ready. Sure. I think you should check that out. Yeah. I'm particularly interested in knowing about the AI ethics part here. And I think you are primarily working on in this field, like, you know, so can you throw some light on it? Like, you know, like, what is AI ethics? Like, you know, in so that it is understood to everyone, like, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, no, it's not necessarily my main field, but it's something that I think anyone who is building a tool in the AI space needs to take seriously and consider. I would say, you know, AI ethics is a very, you know, kind of broad question. It starts with, how is the content ingested, right? Was it with permission? Was it without permission? And then how is the content, you know, what's the outputs that we're getting? Is it biased? Is it hallucinating? Is it, you know, there's all sorts of issues, but let's focus specifically on AI research ethics, okay? Because I think that's that's where I can maybe add a little bit more. And I think in the research context, you know, we've had for many years, we've had issues that have, you know, arisen with paper mills and with, you know, just fraudulent research. And I think that AI tools are both the problem and the cure. So what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is, on the one hand, AI tools can really be used to detect fraudulent research that never was able to be detected before. So for example, one really great example of this is image detection, right? So there are a few companies out there, there's Proofig, ImageTwin. They're doing really great work in being able to automatically scan research articles and determine whether there's duplicate images or there's fraudulent images, or, you know, and that's really important. And I think everyone was surprised by how frequent this issue is. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that the researchers are doing something intentionally bad. Sometimes it's just a mistake of which image they put in, but it's quite frequent. So we need to address it and think about it. And that's a really great example of how AI can help solve a problem which always existed. And now all of a sudden we're making the research literature better because of it. On the flip side, you know, if we're thinking about the issues, well, all of a sudden, you know, there have been a number of stories recently where, you know, studies have been published with the, you know, lines directly from GPT, right? It's very clear that GPT wrote this article, or, you know, wrote big parts of it. You know, you have situations where artificial intelligence images are showing up in research papers. Now, if those images are actually accurate portrayals of the science, I have no problem with them. But as soon as they, you know, are something more than that, then all of a sudden we have issues.
Okay, that's solid foundation of for understanding AI ethics. What about data privacy in scholarly communication? How we can ensure that, like, I mean, while using this tools like ChatGPT or, like, you know, other models?
Yeah, that's a really important question, because there's a lot of misunderstanding. I think that people, you know, people oftentimes look at it as a binary. Either it's safe to use GPT or it's not safe to use GPT. Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. What I mean by that is, first of all, we need to be aware of what data we're handing over to these tech companies when we're using their platforms, right? So for example, with GPT, if you use the free version, they reserve the right, and I think makes sense that they do, to use the inputs that you have given them to learn and to train the next round of their algorithms. Now, they may well turn around. I don't think that means that all of a sudden your texts are going to start showing up elsewhere on the internet. That's a common myth that I hear from researchers. Well, if I give them my text, and all of a sudden someone else is going to be able to find it. I don't think so. But you are giving OpenAI permissions to use that for training their own models for all sorts of other things, which you may or may not be comfortable with. On the other hand, if you connect to, you know, ChatGPT via the API and via the paid service, then all of a sudden they have, at least in their commitment and their terms and conditions, they're not going to be learning from those texts. And in theory, it's entirely private. So that's a really important question before you start using any tools. It's kind of, where is my data going? How is it being used? And these are legitimate questions. Most companies have policies up on their website, you know, to kind of declare that. Again, I haven't yet seen scenarios where a researcher says, oh my God, I put up my data set into this tool, and then all of a sudden I found it somewhere else online, you know, a week later, you know, and kind of, you know, lose that, that privacy. That being said, that doesn't mean it can't happen. It doesn't mean it's not happening in, maybe, you know, in the dark web or in other places. So I think it's important to kind of check out the background of who's building these tools, right? Have they gotten approbations from, you know, kind of reputable sources? Are they people who have built things in the past, the people that are involved in the scholarly publishing industry, or are these kind of, you know, maybe shadier players? Because in any market, right, and if there's an opportunity to manipulate, you know, someone will take that up. But that doesn't automatically mean that everyone who's doing this kind of thing is going to all of a sudden be starting to share your privacy. So I wouldn't, you know, I think that a balanced approach is right, whereby you're careful, you check, but it doesn't, you know, you don't need to not use any of these tools because someone might or something might. I mean, we even know, you know, even when you're submitting your article to a journal, right, you've got the reviewers who are seeing it, the editorial staff. At a certain point, we have to expose ourselves and we have to kind of share, right? Or if we share with a colleague who's going to give us feedback, or, you know, so anyway, I think there's what to be said for, you know, kind of thinking about, you know, what is reasonable and rational when it comes to these questions.
That's nice. So Avi, for the researchers who are basically listening to our talk, are very eager, like, you know, to integrate AI into their workflows. So could you shed some light on, like, you know, from where they should begin, or, like, you know, how do they can scale from novice to expert level? Like, what should be their foundation whenever they want to integrate AI?
Yeah, so it's funny you ask that, because I asked myself the same question about 6 months ago. I started joining WhatsApp groups and started, you know, kind of like engaging with other researchers. And it was a little bit, it felt a little bit like wild, wild west, right? Where it was like, everyone was kind of, you know, just learning on the, in a different way. And it was chaos. And it was, so I actually put together a course, a free course online called AI Tool Up Tuesdays. And the goal for this course was actually to help researchers get some organization and clarification around the different tools. And I actually invited the entrepreneurs who built the tools to come and present their tools as part of the course. So I know that's, you know, shameless self-promotion, but I do think it's a free course, so I'm not making anything off of this. But you know, it's an opportunity for everyone to go in, and you can, and what I would suggest doing is looking at the subjects. So I tried to organize them thematically. And so that, you know, if you want to learn about how to do literature search with AI, you can do that. You want to learn about writing and editing with AI, you can do that, or image detection, or, you know, anything else. So that's kind of the first, you know, step. And I, and the second tip I would give is don't try to build a whole new workflow, you know, with 10 different tools, you know, tomorrow. I think it's enough, you know, study, see what's out there. You know, similar to what we said about the literature review, start with 10 tools, you know, think about which ones you want to learn about, see which ones are really going to be most impactful on your research. Start working with 2-3 tools maximum. You know, maybe one day there'll be one big tool to rule them all, but for now it's very siloed into different subject areas and different tools. So, you know, start practicing. Don't be afraid. Don't give up if you come across, you know, something that you think is a hallucination or isn't, you know, didn't give you the answer you wanted. Continue practicing. You know, I like to compare it. I always say, pretend like you're engaging with an intern on their first day of work who has infinite potential for knowledge, right? They're a genius, but right now they don't know anything, right? So we need to teach them everything. We need to engage with them. We need to be very clear about how we prompt, how we give them instructions. You know, and I think that's, if you pretend like you have to describe it in the same way you would describe a new concept to a, you know, a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old or an intern, I think that helps us to kind of get a better picture of what it is that we're doing. You know, I also have been doing more recently boot camps for academic universities, where actually I come in either via Zoom or in person, where I actually teach the researchers how to use these tools. And we do hands-on 1 or 2 day, you know, kind of deep dives into these tools. So that's another way just for me to be able to teach, you know, because I think it's really important. It's really valuable, but there isn't necessarily, because it's happened so fast, there isn't necessarily, you know, a structured, organized course, you know, and that's what I've been trying to fill that gap.
See, that's pretty, pretty great. So I'll definitely try out your course. Is it on YouTube or like, I didn't?
No, what you need to do is it's actually on the SciWriter website. So it's, and we can maybe share this in the show notes, but yeah, sure. SciWriter.ai/AI-tools-research, -4-research. So that's SciWriter.ai/AI-tools-4-research, or just do a Google search for SciWriter AI Tool Up Tuesdays, and it'll come up, and you just need to, you know, and then you'll see all the whole course, and you can access it, you know, on demand whenever you want.
That's great. I'll try that out definitely. And we'll also share this link on our page.
Perfect.
Podcast. Coming to the last question, like, you know, what do you think, where are we going ahead? What's the future in scholarly communication when we talk about generative AI, LLMs? What do you think about it?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, there's going to be a legal question that's asked about, you know, kind of what are the AI, you know, LLMs able to ingest and whatnot, what are the licensing agreements around that look like? But then I also think there's a question of how authors are going to use it. How do we protect research integrity? How do we increase research integrity with AI tools? And what does it mean, you know, and at what point do we start trusting AI for certain parts of the authoring process or certain parts of the data processing process better than humans? And that's, I think, a really scary question, but maybe an important question to ask, right? At what point do we have papers communicating with other papers, right? And how do we structure the metadata in a way that is feasible? And I think these are exciting questions for researchers, but also scary at the same time. So, you know, my approach is always, you know, the best way to get over any fear is to actually engage and actually start learning. And I think that's where we're at the learning stage now, right? And when you learn and when researchers learn about these tools, so then I think, you know, they'll be able to really kind of you know, understand where it works for them, where it doesn't work for them. And also understand that this is an evolving process, right? Where like, imagine everyone should think back to their first time using the internet and it would come up slowly, you know, on your screen and you'd have to know the exact URL to plug in. And, you know, I can imagine that back then many people were probably like, ah, the internet, you know, not such a, you know, not so helpful, or Wikipedia, right? I know in academia, we were very skeptical of Wikipedia. Wikipedia, no, that's no good. We can't use that. And now it's like, everyone uses Wikipedia and we've actually realized it's a great, you know, the crowdsourcing model is really, can really be incredibly helpful. So anyway, point is that I think that's, you know, really kind of, let's continue experimenting, continue. It's an exciting time. Don't be worried about your jobs and all the fear mongering that's going on. Just start playing and experimenting. On the one hand, you'll see it has big faults. And on the other hand, you'll see it has big opportunities. And that's the way to use it best.
Yeah, that's very thoughtful. It's clear that we are on the brink of exciting developments. I think that will definitely shape the landscape of scholarly communications for years to come. And with that, like, you know, we have, I think we should conclude now today's podcast. I want to extend my heartfelt thanks to Avi Stamen for sharing his expertise and insight with us. Your contributions have truly enriched our understanding of AI and academic research. Thanks, Avi. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much, Pravi. I appreciate the invite, and I look forward to continuing our chat when we know more about AI.
Yeah, sure. Definitely.